Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very happy to have Stephen Allen on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Roaming Ghostland, The Final Days of East Germany. For those of you who don't know, and I suspect all of you do know, there was a place called East Germany until about 1990. It was a product of the Cold War, and it ended when the Cold War ended. But there was a very brief period between November 1989 and I believe October 1990 in which East Germany sort of existed and didn't exist. It was still there, and so were the East Germans, but everyone knew that it was going to pass out of existence. And Steve Allen was lucky enough to be there and to record his impressions. This is a terrific book in a number of ways. It artfully weaves Steve's own story in with the story of the then collapsing and disappearing East Germany. I highly recommend you read it. It's a great gift for anyone who is interested in becoming a foreign correspondent or wants to know anything about being a foreign correspondent, because Steve tells us exactly what he did day to day and how difficult it was. So it's the story of Steve and the story of East Germany. And in that way, it makes for a terrific read. Without any further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Marshall, how are you doing today?
I'm very well. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Stephen Allen today, and we'll be discussing his book, Roaming Ghostland, The Final Days of East Germany. As everyone knows who listens to this podcast, I read these books before I do the interviews, and I have to say that I really enjoyed reading this book, and I highly recommend it to everyone. It does something that's really marvelous, and we'll talk about this in the course of the interview, because it weaves Stephen's story into the story of the collapsing East Germany. It's a wonderful device, and Steve brings it off perfectly, I think perfectly, really pitch perfectly. He has a real talent and flair for writing that most people that write in historical genres, I think, don't, and I would include myself in that category. So I just wanted to begin by congratulating Stephen for writing a really terrific and readable book that is both about him and about this really very interesting moment in history in this country that existed and then didn't exist. It was sort of, it's Halloween tomorrow. I'm cognizant of that because my children are going to go run around. So it was really, he got to East Germany in the moment in which everyone living there was among the undead. You know, they weren't quite West Germans yet. They weren't quite Germans, and they weren't quite East. They really weren't, they were neither fish nor fowl. And it was a particularly interesting moment at that time. So Stephen, why don't you let me ask you to begin, let me ask you to begin the interview with telling us a little bit about yourself, where you're from and where you grew up and how you became interested in these matters.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me as your guest. I greatly appreciate it. And I'm flattered that you took the time to read the book, and that your listeners are so engaged in history. I grew up in a town called Modesto, California. I was born in Minnesota, and my parents, like a lot of Midwesterners, wanted to get out of Minnesota, and they moved to California, where I grew up. My love of German and Germany, German was not my language growing up, and I didn't have any relatives that spoke it. However, I had a terrific teacher in high school, and I just fell in love with Germany, and I had the good fortune to go over there as a teenager, and it seemed like the countries I went to, everybody was speaking German, Austria, Germany, Switzerland, and even I was able to go to the Soviet Union back in 1976, and that was a second language for some people there as well. I went on to a career in journalism after graduating from the University of California at Davis, where I majored in German and international studies. I had gone over to Germany, I think, four or five times before I went over to report as a foreign correspondent in 1990. And that's a little bit of my background. If you have any more questions or I missed anything, Marshall,
no,
please.
That's fine. Let me ask you this, because I think that I used to work in journalism myself. What was it like? What was it like deciding to become a journalist? Because that's kind of a difficult decision, isn't it?
You know, I think, yeah. And today I think it's an even more frightening, difficult decision because of the enormous pressures on journalism as an industry and the whole way the internet has transformed, you know, modern journalism. I mean, I would not recommend anybody go into traditional journalism today. But at the time, one of my first jobs was at the Modesto Bee, which is a Sacramento, you know, McClatchy chain. And I got to cover high school sports, and they paid me, I think this was back in the late 70s, I was making $10 an hour. And I thought, wow, that's pretty darn good for a kid. And I'm writing, and I'm writing about something that I'm interested in. And that's really what gave me the bug to become a journalist. And the reason I didn't study journalism is I thought I should know something about what I'm writing about. And my dream was always to be a foreign correspondent. That was really the mother lode for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And which is another reason why the book was so important for me to write, and mm-hmm. the culmination of everything I had been interested in with journalism.
Mm-hmm. I see. It's a tough decision today. I counsel a lot of undergraduates who want to go into journalism, and as I say, I worked there myself in a very low capacity for some time, and it is a very tough game. But I want to begin a discussion of the book by having you talk a little bit about your really very brave decision to leave your extraordinarily good day job in journalism in Florida and just jump ship and go to really where the action was in East Germany. And this was in 1990, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. The wall came down in November of 1989. And I thought to myself, my gosh, what an opportunity. I speak German. I work for a great newspaper. My editor will see how brilliant I am and value my ability to speak the language and know the culture, and he'll send me over if I only ask. Well, I went to my editor at the St. Pete Times, and he looked at me and, you know, kind of condescendingly said, thanks, but no thanks. And I was really devastated because I thought, wow, this is an opportunity for me to help the paper but do something that I really have dreamed of my whole life. And so I was confronted with the decision, which was sit there and stew over it and, you know, cover the crime beat, cover city halls and pot-bellied redneck sheriffs and that whole thing, or roll the dice and try to get over to Europe and freelance. And so I was fortunate to have the St. Petersburg Times is a wonderful, wonderful newspaper, and it feeds into a lot of the bigger papers, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times. So I had a lot of contacts in journalism, and they were very helpful and encouraging as I was plotting my exit strategy from the St. Pete Times. And so I was able to leave, and I had it all pretty much wired by February of 1990, which was a couple months after the wall came down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so then you just decide to go. But then there was another consideration. This is part of what makes this book, which is really a sort of hybrid of genres, interesting. Very early on, there's a woman involved.
Yeah, who is now my wife. It's kind of funny. I was born in 1960, so I'm 49 right now. And it seems like every major decade of my life, I do something I don't know how to put it, something significant, something life-changing. And so I was 29 when the wall came down, and I don't know how many of your listeners or what the demographics are, but when you shift from one decade to another, 29 to 30, 39 to 40, and I'm 49 now, I'm going to turn 50 next year. I don't know, for me it's just kind of a wake-up call and a chance to take an inventory of what am I doing with my life. And at the time the wall came down, I was also living with a woman that I had fallen in love with, and I was really torn between going to Germany and not wanting to blow this relationship. And fortunately, she was the one who encouraged me to go. And I think it was at that point I knew I could marry her if she was secure enough to encourage me to pursue my dream. So on the day I gave my notice, which was January 2nd, 1990, when I quit my job, it was the same day I proposed to her.
That's a terrific story. I guess it's a good send off in a way. But also I want to tell our readers that this is, that Maureen is her name. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, Maureen comes and goes in the book, and that's another terrific. We're never allowed to, just as you were never allowed to forget Maureen while you were in East Germany, we are never allowed to forget that you're thinking about Maureen. I don't know if she listens to this, but yeah, it's really I enjoyed it whenever she came up. So you fly to I guess someplace in West Germany, and then you're going to go into East Germany. Had you ever been to East Germany before?
I had been to East Berlin.
Uh huh.
I think in 1985, so it was still in the shadows of communism, when I was over there, I was working at the Washington Post at the time, and I had gone over for a vacation, and I got one of the 24-hour, 12-hour visas that you could get, which really was a way of East Germany getting hard currency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they charged you to do that. And I met a guy who was a poet and had smuggled out some of his poetry. And I hung out with him for the day. And we went to all the Western stores where you could buy Western goods. And I bought him a bottle of whiskey. And he thought he was in a John Wayne movie. And it was really a lot of fun. And it was so intriguing to me because it was so different from West Berlin. And it was almost like, and I felt this a lot when I was over there reporting, because I was back and forth over the wall and into East Germany constantly. It was like moving between a grainy black and white TV show or movie, and then suddenly coming into a full color, high def picture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I had almost exactly the same experience in about 1984. I was taking the train from Leningrad, as it was then, to Helsinki, and I'd been in Russia for a little bit, and or in the Soviet Union for a number of months, and I'd kind of gotten used to seeing things in the kind of Soviet way. And I remember going into Helsinki, and Helsinki has no great shakes. I'm sorry to my Finnish fans, but you know, that's a nice place. But I remember going there and just thinking, somebody turned the lights on.
Right.
It was amazing. Like, look at this. Somebody just turned the lights on. And there it is, civilization. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. So I had been to East Berlin in 1985, and I had corresponded with this poet several times. And each time I would – and I still have some of his letters – they were taped shut. You could tell they had been opened up and resealed by the Stasi, the secret police. And I spent a fair amount of time trying to look him up when I went back over and couldn't find him. Like a lot of things, there was just so much upheaval. I'd also been to the former Soviet Union back in 1976, as I had mentioned, and there was always something very dark and compelling about the Eastern Bloc to me. I don't know. It might just be a personality thing or what, but you know, I still have never been to Greece, or you know, I just recently went to Italy, but I've never really been to the you know, the real sunny, popular European tourist places. I always tend to go to the gray, dark, dismal portions of Europe, and I don't know why, but I've always been drawn to the Eastern Bloc.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are compelling places. So when you arrived, you go over to East Germany, what was the mood of people there in early 1990?
Well, it was interesting. I know that on the Western side, there was enormous pressure to find. I mean, I needed to find a place to live. And I spent a fair amount of time trying to decide, do I live in East Berlin where I could probably live very, very cheaply for a long time, or do I set up shop in West Berlin? And the primary reason I set up in West Berlin was because of the phone system and the infrastructure was so deficient in East Germany and East Berlin. And these were back in the internet days, the pre-internet days, where you would send a story by the telephone line.
Mm-hmm.
Would plug your phone into a computer. I don't know, some of your listeners may remember this, and you had to type in bauds and bit rates and special codes. And each newspaper I sent stories to, I had to type in the special code. And then I would have to send it in pieces over telephone line.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take a whole day for me sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the technological infrastructure was a big line of demarcation or contrast between the two
mm-hmm.
the two worlds. As far as the mood, I think this is something I string through the book, and I think, or I hope comes through, is that what Americans saw, and I presumably in New Zealand and Australia and all over the world, South America, what people saw in that moment when the wall came down, they saw Germans coming together, they saw people sitting on the wall, standing and dancing with champagne and total euphoria. By the time I got there, it was a couple months later, and I think the euphoria had started to wear off a little bit, and the reality was setting in. The mood of the East Germans, I think, was I was astounded that it wasn't so much about freedom and being able to speak out against government or to be able to vote in free elections. To me, what really came across as a driving force for the East Germans was the economy,
mm-hmm.
the ability to buy Western goods, the ability to travel, the ability to, you know, so that is a form of freedom, but it was heavily an economic freedom and an economic liberation that I think they were looking at, and that surprised me. And then, of course, on the West German side, you had the reality was, okay, now we've got to absorb these people who are ostensibly our brethren. And so I think by the time I got there, the mood was a real strange mix of excitement and complexity and concern and logistics. How is this whole thing going to work? And, of course, East Germany still was its own country.
Mm-hmm.
And there were they had to have a national election to decide what direction they wanted to head.
Mm-hmm.
And the election is a big part of the early section of the book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, you go to various East German towns where members of the CDU and the SPD and these other political parties are stumping. And how do the East Germans react to this? Because since they haven't really ever seen electoral politics before.
Yeah. Well, again, it was interesting, and I think a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, are heavily academic historians, and this book is very anecdotal, and
all the better.
Yeah, and I think looking at your website and the purpose for your historical center is to provide a context, and I think this adds a nice little dimension of I think humanity to what went on, you know, historically.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very street level account, and I talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of East Germans every day. It seemed like, and the election was, a lot of them, I don't think, understood it. You know, it was the first time in their lives they could vote freely in an election.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were told they could vote in free elections before, but it was obvious they didn't. And what was fascinating was what would it be like? If Canada had been a part of the United States a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly the Canadians could vote to become
the 51st state.
They were going to vote on their government, and that our Republican and Democratic political parties went into Canada and funded the whole campaign, and we had Obama and all the Republicans and Democrats going into Canada and campaigning. That's really what it was like. You had Helmut Kohl, the chancellor. You had all the political parties going into East Germany campaigning for their straw people. They set up their parties inside. There was very little organic political development of the parties. You were looking at almost like a microwaved version of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the Communist Party, which was there to begin with, and outside of that, and you had a group called New Forum, Neues Forum, and they had formed some coalitions, but it was really a juggernaut from the West.
Mm-hmm.
And a little funny anecdote, I had some of the political flyers and leaflets that had been handed out by the CDU, and I think I was in Leipzig or Dresden, and I was showing them to some of the East Germans, and they looked at me and they said, "These weren't printed here. We don't have this quality paper. We can't get this kind of color.
Yeah.
This is not from here." And so, again, back to the U.S.-Canada example, it would be as if all the flyers and everything had been printed in the West. And so that was fascinating to me, is that it was, in some ways, it was a takeover by the West.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very strong power play. And the East Germans I talked to honestly, most of these Germans seemed to be fine with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there any, you mentioned the German Communist Party, which obviously had ruled Germany, at least in name, for many decades by then. Did they mount any sort of campaign themselves?
Yeah, they had a group that formed, and with some of their, I believe it was Gregor Gysi, who was the head of that party. What was interesting is they did very well in East Berlin, which was obviously the capital of the federal government there. And so you had a lot of government. Well, I guess technically everybody's a government worker, but
mm-hmm.
the hardcore communist members were in Berlin, and they actually did a little bit better in Berlin. And ironically, I'm sure people have lived in Germany and the Germans themselves. I mean, there's a very, I think, proud and rich tradition of protest among West German students and West Germans in general, on the younger generation. And I was astounded at some of the political campaigning in West Berlin for communism.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed very surreal to me that, mm-hmm. It was so evident traveling through East Germany that the country was broken, the people were broken, the system was broken. And, what they were moving to and how they moved to it, I think, was a very much a subject of debate and interest. But the fact that, I think it was irrefutable that the system didn't work.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think that's right. I was actually in the Soviet Union as it became Russia, or the Russian Federation, in 91, 92. I was there for that. And I saw many of the same things that you saw, in the sense that, I guess I would say, there were just certain parallels. When these communist systems come undone, the same kinds of things happen. At least I noticed some of the things that you noticed. One example was, and I'll just run through some quick ones and ask you to talk about them. One of the things that amazed me in Russia in 1990-91 was the fact that everybody was selling everything. People would just stand out on street corners, markets would form, and people would just sell anything that they mm-hmm. had. And you saw that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, well, there were kind of two levels of that. One was in East Germany itself. You actually had a lot of the, you know, suddenly you had a new market for West Germany, and you had, for example, in Leipzig, the city square had all sorts of products and booths that had been set up. You know, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were there. You know, I remember Michael Jackson was big back then, and he transcended. I mean, it's kind of interesting. You can say what you want about him, his lifestyle, his music, or whatever, but he really transcended geographic and political boundaries, and mm-hmm. he was huge over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember, you know, all the West German newspapers were there trying to, you know, they saw a new market there for him, I think, and had set up shop. The East Germans couldn't believe that they could select from, you know, 10 newspapers, 15 newspapers,
mm-hmm.
Instead of just the communist rag. I was in one line. One of my favorite little stories is I'm in this very long line. They call them Schlangen, which is for, it's like a snake, a long mm-hmm. line. And everybody was just, you know, you had everything from senior citizens to young kids. But I'm thinking it's, I don't know, some great kind of chocolate or entertainment device or, you know, video game or something. And I get to the front and it's some pornographic material for, you know, kind of soft porn, you know, like lingerie and stuff like that. And the East Germans were just, they just couldn't believe it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, so I think they were really hit. So there was a lot of selling in East Germany of Western goods and products, and then on the in West Germany, you had probably one of my favorite stories in the whole book is I met some kids from East Germany that were selling pieces of the wall to Westerners for Western currency,
mm-hmm.
and there was another gentleman who actually had, I think, quit his job and was selling the wall full time,
mm-hmm.
and what was so significant about that is you could make hard currency, you could sell them for Deutschmarks, go back into East Germany and trade the, you know, the marks basically were, you know, depending on the time, you know, 5-1, 6-1, East German marks to West. And so you could live like a king if you had Western currency.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for that reason, a lot of the East Germans that I met around the wall were selling chunks of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I even saw some kids spray painting little chunks of the wall in an effort, or they weren't even chunks of the wall. I think they were just rocks they were finding on the ground that they were spray painting and trying to sell them to tourists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, this is something I saw too, that is in addition to these in Russian, they're called talkuchki, these little markets that would form. And another thing that I experienced when I was there is the decline of the ruble and tons of speculation in foreign currency. And you actually quote some prices, you know, you could buy an entire meal for $3, a really nice meal. And that was true in 91 in Moscow when we were there. You know, we really had dollars and we could exchange them, you know, right in front of the Kremlin, basically, you know, in the open air with currency traders, because there were lots of arbitrage possibilities. You could trade dollars for rubles, and then you could take the rubles and buy something and then sell them again for dollars, and you could always come out on the plus side. But that's something that we experienced as well. And I mean, it was sad in a way because I saw people's savings. And, you know, Soviet people did have savings, and I'm sure East Germans did too. I saw their savings wiped out, mm-hmm. you know, almost overnight. And, you know, that was an extremely...
Well, and I think that's why the currency reform, there was really a lot of pressure to do a one-for-one, you know, trade with when they did unify. And I'm a little less familiar with the actual unification as opposed to the period between reunification or the wall coming down and reunification,
mm-hmm.
and that's really the focus of the book is that sliver of time between those two big events. The other thing I wanted to talk about briefly, if you don't mind, on the economic front, and the trading, it certainly was like the Wild West. I mean, there was a lot of wheeling and dealing, and, you know, the police kind of turned their heads the other way when they saw, you know, black currency trading going on.
Mm-hmm.
But a very interesting thing to me was, and I wrote a whole story on it when I was over there, and it features, I think, fairly prominently in the book, was it wasn't like the West Germans were, you know, helping the East Germans understand or giving them tutorials in the free market. Many East Germans, I think, had to learn the hard way. They weren't used to credit cards and buying things on credit.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't used to having a million choices.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't used to putting money down on something.
Mm-hmm.
And a psychiatrist that I interviewed who dealt with a lot of the East Germans who were trying to make the transition to a Western, you know, society, she said, look, we've been deformed.
Mm-hmm.
And the classic example to me is there were flyers that went out warning people about buying, they called it die Katze im Sack, which is, we say pig in a poke in English,
mm-hmm.
And they call it a cat in a sack. You wouldn't buy a cat in a sack.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, there were a lot of stories of East Germans being hoodwinked by Westerners and taken to the cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
And the example that jumps out at me even 20 years later is there was a story about everybody wanted a Mercedes. Yeah, and there was a story about somebody who went to look and test drive a Mercedes from a West German, a used one, and the West German said, okay, give me X amount of dollars now. We'll meet tomorrow, or not dollars, but marks.
Marks, yeah.
Marks. Give those to me now, so, you know, pay me 2,000-3,000 Deutschmarks now. Come back and bring the rest to me tomorrow, and I'll have the car waiting for you. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
The person never shows up with the car, and he walks away with,
right,
you know, 3,000 Deutschmarks, and this poor East German has been suckered. And so there were countless stories like that taking place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I experienced many things. Well, not many things, but some things like this in 91 when I was in the East. Tell us, if you will, I also another thing that struck me was just the weirdness of the place. And again, this is, I'm speaking about the Soviet Union here, but I think I found some of it in your book as well, the weirdness of these transitions. And one of the anecdotes I particularly like was the anecdote about kangaroo soup.
Oh, right.
Tell us about kangaroo soup.
Yeah, I know. You're left scratching your head at things that took place in a communist society. And one of them was, I'm in a restaurant, and it was in East Berlin, I believe, and kangaroo soup was on the menu, and I'm thinking, what is that all about? I've got to try it, right? And it was just, I think, some brown water with a little flecks of meat, you know, and I complained, and she was, the waitress was very indignant. I'm like, are you sure this is kangaroo? And she was certain it was, but to me it looked like, I don't know, some shaved pieces of beef or something. And since you have a worldwide audience, I would love to know from the Australians or New Zealanders,
yeah,
if any historical proof that the kangaroo soup in a can was something ever sent to East Germany.
Yeah, well, please, those of you in New Zealand and Australia or wherever there are kangaroos, and you please write me and tell me, and I'll pass on your understanding of the thing to Stephen.
Yeah. So the other thing that was really bizarre was just the utter lack of customer service. And I think anybody who's been to a communist country gets that. You know, you want one loaf of bread, you get one loaf of bread. And the Germans, you know, you don't get to choose, and they don't really care if you're happy or not. And it was funny to be over there knowing that the whole world was transforming, and you'd see people who were just, you could just tell they weren't going to function well in this, mm-hmm, new society. They weren't going to make that transition. just very peculiar rules too. Like I remember being in a grocery store in East Berlin, and the person got all bent out of shape that I wasn't pushing a cart.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I just wanted to buy, I think, a bar of chocolate or a six pack of beer or something. And, but they definitely had their rules, and no, that's not just East Germany. I think Germany as a whole, can be very, very focused, at least the older generation.
You mentioned one of the things that I think every American who goes to Germany notices immediately, and that is that Germans don't cross against the light. Mm-hmm. Even when there's no traffic. Every American I've ever met who's been to Germany, it's the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
I think I still have burns in my back from the glares I've received from doing that.
Yeah.
But I think that mindset in a lot of ways is even more pronounced, or was even more pronounced in East Germany. You talk about, looking back on it, I mean, there was something very endearing about the East German people, not the government, not the economy, but the people themselves were really, really solid. Really, I met so many nice, thoughtful, intelligent, and humorous people. I met a guy in a Cuban restaurant with his girlfriend, and he was a younger guy, and he said he was graduating from college. He was in Leipzig, and I like, what did you major in? And he said, centrally planned economy.
Yeah.
And he just laughed. He's like, what am I going to do with that? So I think there was a sense of a huge sense of irony. And I think a lot of people had to chuckle, and even though they were probably hurting at the same time a lot, I think there was a real sense that a lot of, especially with the older generation, that they'd really spent their life living on a pile of lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I found that same thing in the Soviet Union at the time. People had they were resentful because they had really invested a lot in the system, and they had believed in it when it was failing, and they had given it second, third, fourth, and fifth chances. And then to see it all come undone like that, especially so suddenly, was, I think, to a shock to many really well-meaning people. I mean, I knew people in the Soviet Union who joined the party the year before the party ceased to exist, basically, and they were very nice people, and they really were very accomplished. And I'm thinking of one woman in particular. She was really a good person, and really cared about the Soviet Union and wanted to work. She wasn't a careerist or anything like that, and she was absolutely bewildered when basically the whole thing went pear-shaped overnight. Let me ask you to tell a story of I believe it's a taxi driver. And you have you can tell the story. It's the story of the joke.
Right. And I believe Milan Kundera wrote a whole book on the joke, which is, people who, about somebody or telling a joke about a communist leader, could end you up in prison. And I had a taxi driver in, I believe it was Dresden, and he was driving me around, and they call them Schwarz taxis, is just not an official cab, but you make a deal with a guy with a car, and he says, hey, I'll show you around the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very distinctly we negotiated on the front end as to the terms of our payment. And I remember specifically saying I'd pay you in East German marks, and anyway, that figures into the story. But he's driving me around, showing me Dresden, and telling me at the same time about how he ended up in jail for telling a joke with some coworkers, and somebody ratted on him, and he ended up in prison. And it was a very compelling story. And then at the very end, he was really pulling on my heartstrings. And then when the drive was over and I went to pay him, he kind of went ballistic because I gave him East German marks. And so I acquiesced and gave him the Deutschmark payment. And, I end that little chapter talking about how you know, the joke was really on me. I think he played me like a fiddle.
I think he did, and I'd been played like that in the Soviet Union as well. But you don't give yourself enough credit. I mean, the way you explain it in the book, and I'm sure it's true, is that you opened your wallet and basically gave him all your money.
There are people that, you really felt for the people, you knew they were onto a better life and a better society, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
But the transition is what this book is all about. It's about that window of time between the whole world seeing these happy champagne-drinking Germans all getting together and reunification. And that period in between is, to me, very pivotal, and it's very full of drama and human emotion and the clash of West and East could not be stronger than in Germany at that time, at that moment in time. And that, to me, is where all the richness and texture and I hope a little bit of insight is provided by the book to augment and complement, you know, what else has been written by more preeminent historians than me.
No, it certainly does. No, these things are very valuable. You can learn a lot from a simple anecdote that you can't learn from a formal academic book. I want you to talk about, this is again another parallel with the Soviet experience, I'd like you to talk about interviewing people who are thinking about whether they should change the name of their city from Karl Marx Stadt to Chemnitz.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, I live in California, and there's a city here called City of Industry.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, Karl Marx Stadt was kind of like City of Industry. It was kind of a bland, predictable, you know, kind of inappropriate, especially that time of that time in history. But you had a city that had been when the communists took over, they renamed the city from Chemnitz to Karl Marx Stadt. And I think this is really a beautiful little vignette of how the democracy in this fledgling period or fledgling democracy actually worked. The folks in the city got together and they had a ballot initiative. This was back, I believe, in April of 1990. They had a referendum on whether or not to change the city's name from Karl Marx to back to its original name, Chemnitz. And you think of all the names, you know, like Ho Chi Minh City.
Mm-hmm.
Even places like Beijing have used to be Peking, but this had such a strong, visceral, political charge about it that, I think the people really felt like this is something we can control. We can take the name back of our city and erase this communist stamp on our city. And, the vote itself was, about 76% to restore the old name.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a real clear mandate to go back to get rid of communism and this symbol of communism. So it was a fascinating little piece of what was going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the things that bears pointing out, as you do in the book, is that Marx didn't really ever have anything to do with the city that at one time bore his name. Rhinelander, really, wasn't he?
Yeah, I believe he was born in Trier.
Yeah.
It was really an alien name being foisted on, you know. It'd be like us going into Havana and calling it, Washington.
Yeah, right, exactly. Another thing I wanted you to talk about was, and this is something of particular interest to me, I spent some time in Germany and actually lived with a family that was from territories that are now Poland. They were from East Prussia, and East Prussia doesn't exist anymore. Old Prussia doesn't exist anymore, I think. And you spend some time with some people from Gdansk or Danzig. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And for those of you who don't know, among our listeners, this was the area of Eastern Germany that was given to Poland in 1945, and all of the German residents, some millions of them, were forcibly moved into Germany proper. So anyway, why don't you talk a little bit about these people that you meant from Gdansk?
Yeah, well, there's, you know, Poland figures in so prominently in the history of Germany. It's so, they're so intertwined. But on Easter Sunday, I had met, along with a reporter from Ireland, a wonderful, wonderful man. If there's anybody from Ireland listening, I'd love to know where he's ended up, and hopefully he's still alive. A guy named Fergus Pyle.
Okay.
He used to write for the Irish Times.
Uh-huh. So listeners, find Fergus Pyle and contact me, okay?
Yeah. I mean, he's just a wonderful travel companion. He was, you know, senior to me and really, you know, it was nice being with a seasoned journalist like him. But we went to an Easter Mass in East Germany and or West Germany, West Berlin, and met a couple women from you know, who it turned out were very wealthy. We ended up going, they invited us back to their house for coffee and you know, some whiskey, and we obviously had fooled them that we were somehow legitimate, professional, good gentlemen, but they invited us in, and they were older women, and they proceeded to tell us they were originally from Danzig, you know, which is Gdansk,
mm-hmm.
Home of Solidarity in Lech Walesa, and you know, that they had been driven from that area after the war, I guess they had owned sugar and flour flour processing factories in Warsaw and Danzig, and you know, they ended up having to flee after the war, so they lost everything,
mm-hmm.
But were very proud of remaining you know, Prussians,
mm-hmm.
is more how they thought of themselves, but that really was a kind of a nice jumping off point into, you know, going to explore Poland. It's the one time and one piece of the book that strays away from Germany.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why don't you talk a little bit about your time in Poland?
Yeah, it was probably the longest day trip I've ever spent in my life. Fergus Pyle had a really state-of-the-art slick car. It was a Citroen, French Citroen, and we headed off to Gdansk, and we thought that there might be something interesting about the revolution that had taken place, you know, at the shipyards in Gdansk, and to see if we were fishing for stories, basically,
mm-hmm.
And thought there might be some interesting stuff up there. First of all, Poland is a beautiful country. I had no idea how beautiful it was, and we were there in the springtime, and they have these fields of I believe it's called rape. It's a yellow plant, and it was just this beautiful, vivid countryside. I can't recall anything of major historical value that we came across, but on a personal level, we had some very interesting, kind of funny things take place that I share in the book. One of which, we're pulled over for speeding.
Yeah, right.
And it's clear that the Polish police want us to give them money so that they won't give us a ticket. And so we give them some money, and they say, no, that's not enough. So then we give them a lot more, and they say, no, that's too much. And they basically took our money and counted out what was an appropriate bribe and handed us back the rest of the money, and we just laughed the whole way back.
Yeah, that is
that one.
Yeah, no, I've experienced things like this as well. You talk a little bit about the way the East Germans understood the Holocaust, or did not understand it, because at that time East German or West German television was being shown freely in East Germany all of a sudden. Now, it had always been sort of available, but had been blocked. And I think that they were showing a show about the Holocaust called Genocide or something like this. And
right.
Yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about the way the East Germans understood this television show.
Yeah, this was a great assignment I got from a guy named Roy Guttman, who has won a Pulitzer for his work. Actually, he wrote a book, I believe, called Genocide, about Bosnia and the death camps that had taken place in that part of the world. And he was the European bureau chief for Newsday out of New York, and he was based in Bonn, and he needed somebody in Berlin and East Germany to help, you know, get stories that he couldn't physically be there for. And one of them was this, they were going to have the airing of Genocide, which I believe won an Oscar or, I mean, it was...
yeah, whatever they win, I don't know.
Yeah, and it was, I believe, an American film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to be airing for the first time in East Germany. And he had run into, he had the name of somebody that he met the night the wall came down. And I ended up watching the movie at their house,
mm-hmm.
with this family. And what was fascinating is they had named all their kids, even though they weren't Jewish, I believe they were Catholic, they had given all their kids Jewish names,
mm-hmm.
first names, to, I think, kind of out of respect for what had happened historically to the Jews in Germany.
Mm.
And what was interesting is they said that the girls, actually, they had some teenage girls, and they brought out their history books. And what was fascinating is the atrocities committed by the Nazis from the viewpoint of the Soviets was how they went after the communists,
mm-hmm.
and the leftists. It was the fascists against the communists. It wasn't, you know, this tyrant who had destroyed, you know, or tried to destroy the Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
And so the atrocities of the Holocaust really had been buried,
mm-hmm.
Largely by the Soviet dominated paradigm,
mm-hmm.
because the emphasis was on, you know, that Hitler was a counterpoint to communism. It wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a Jewish issue. So there, the sense I got from that, you know, and again, I don't want to extrapolate that the whole society thought that based on this one interview or several interviews I had, but it was really clear that they hadn't seen or been exposed to the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching this with this family was really incredibly insightful and compelling to see how much their worldview had either been filtered or shaped or deformed or warped,
mm-hmm.
to think a certain way and to not be exposed to other aspects of history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that a whole country could do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In a pre-internet age, that was easy. It's going to be a little harder now, and
yeah.
I don't know how China's doing it.
Yeah, I don't think they're doing it very well, and I agree with you that they won't be able to do it effectively, but I found exactly the same thing in the Soviet Union. I mean, people had a kind of vague street-level awareness of the anti-Semitism, the virulent anti-Semitism of the Nazis, but again, the battle against the Germans in the Second World War was pitched as one of fascism against communism, and atrocities were against any population were deemed to be atrocities against communist,
yeah.
populations, and you know, that was the story that they wanted to tell. But it wasn't, in the Soviet case, it wasn't the story that everybody understood. I mean, everyone kind of knew that this wasn't really the whole truth, and I don't think,
yeah.
it was any great revelation, at least to my friends in the Soviet Union, when they learned that, in fact, there was, you know, a genocidal campaign against the Jews. That wasn't exactly unknown. Another thing that you did, another parallel experience, when I was in the Soviet Union in 1980-something, I don't remember, I was in Kiev in Ukraine, and I had friends that lived near the Babi Yar massacre site, and if you don't know what that is, basically it's the Germans, Einsatzgruppen had murdered some, I think 30,000 Jewish and Ukrainian citizens in a ravine in Kiev, and there it was being excavated as part of a building project. They were building a radio station, and I went there, and the place was completely covered with human remains. It was really quite moving. I'd read about Babi Yar. There is a monument at Babi Yar to the victims, and again, it says it doesn't really mention Jews specifically, but
yeah.
So, but then you also visit a mass grave. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, one of the things that happened, and it's easily the most indelible memory I have of the time I spent over there, was there were these little stories popping up of mass graves being discovered throughout the East German countryside, and they were the graves of Nazi soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And as everybody knows, when the Russians came in, it was a whole, you know, it was a whole different ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a place called Funfeiken, which is Five Oaks. It was up in the northeastern part of East Germany, in the Neubrandenburg area. And again, I was with Fergus Pyle with the Irish Times, and we drove out there, and there was rumored to be a mass grave out in this forest. And we went up there and ran into a man probably in his 60s, maybe early 70s. I'd have to do the math here, but he was an older gentleman, and we started asking him about the graves. We hadn't seen them yet, but we were talking to him, and he said that he was at a concentration camp that was nearby. He was a young boy, I think of 11 or 12, and was, you know, towards the end of the war, the Germans were grabbing any body that was nearby and throwing them into a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hardly as if he was a Nazi believer. He was mm-hmm. just some kid, you know, and they threw a uniform on him, and the Russians came in, and he got thrown in a concentration camp. And then he proceeded to tell us what it was like there, and he lost many of his friends in the concentration camp, and then also the Germans that had died presumably during the war. But the mass graves were largely of people who died, you know, after the war in this concentration camp, mm-hmm. you know, the elderly and the young that didn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we talked to him, you know, the more he kind of opened up with us, and he shared how, you know, his whole life had, he said, we were the shat upon generation.
Mm-hmm.
And he started to cry. He was with his wife and their dog, and he starts to weep. And it was just an incredibly sad moment, because the way he articulated it was, you know, everything he believed in, or didn't even believe in, but everything he was told to believe in had turned out to be a big lie. He, mm-hmm. you know, he grew up with Hitler, you know, in charge, and, you know, that ends him up in a concentration camp. He, you know, gets out and is a little bit ostracized for a while because he was considered a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And so starts to get his life back and have some semblance of normalcy in the communist society. And then, you know, here he is in the twilight of his years, and the whole thing comes down, crashing down, and all the, you know, the state secrets, the spying on the public, the, you know, the corruption and mm-hmm. at the higher levels, all that stuff starts coming out. And he just started to cry, mm-hmm. and it was an incredibly poignant and insightful experience for me, because it, you know, I think growing up in the West, you tend to say, well, the Nazis, they're all bad, mm-hmm. you know, they were all this. Well, you kind of forget that, and the cover of the book is actually of the gravesite that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I should have made a notation of that, but That's one of the mass graves that we saw, and all these relatives were going to find their relatives, and they never could bring closure to people that had died,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't fighting, you know, these were kind of innocent people that had been caught up in World War II on the German side. And it was just an incredibly tragic, sad, unexpected experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a couple of experiences like that in the Soviet Union and actually the 1980s where people were really sort of despondent about the way things were going and they didn't feel they could change and they felt they had been lied to. They had worked very hard in a cause that proved to be corrupt, and I did have similar sorts of experiences, and they were very, very moving. I should also say about the mass graves, they are really being discovered. I think discovered should be in quotes. They're being uncovered all the time. Mm. There was one recently discovered in Czechoslovakia in the old Sudeten territories. And in this instance, if I recall correctly, and maybe one of the listeners can correct me, that it was German civilians who had been killed by Czechs as the Russians came in. And there were lots of atrocities. There were atrocities both in 1939 when the Germans came, and then there were atrocities in 1945 when the Russians kicked them out. And there were plenty of atrocities to go around. And so I think there are a lot of buried and unquiet bodies all over this area. And people only now can kind of begin to face exactly what happened, because it was ethnic cleansing on a scale that I don't think we've ever seen, at least in modern times. And it's something that has never really gotten very much press, particularly on the German side, because, you know, it was thought to be a little bit distasteful to mention it. I was going to say there are several good books now about what happened to the Germans in the closing months of the war, and it was truly horrendous.
And the interesting thing about that is, I think that period of history is so black and white in many ways that to encounter this nuance, you know, the Germans at that time of, you know, when you talk about that period of history, there's not a lot of sympathy.
Mm-mm.
Or, compassion.
Mm-hmm.
For Germany, for that time of year or for that time in history. And so I was kind of surprised that I was actually feeling, you know, sorry for somebody who has grown up in that period. And you're right. It's an interesting little dimension to this that, again, was totally unexpected and really told me that there's a lot more going on here than I think the rest of the world was seeing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right, and we should thank you for bringing the story to us. And, Stephen, we've taken up a heck of a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. Why don't we close the interview by having you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Before I do that, I just wanted to, again, thank you for having me on.
My pleasure.
And, something that you had said earlier, I wanted to kind of come back to because it triggered something, is that, you know, early on when I was there, there had been a cartoon that I saw in one of the Western magazines, and there were three bathrooms, and one of them said Männer, Frauen, and Ossis. And, basically there were three bathroom, you know, assigned, women, men, and Easterners,
yeah.
So anyway, I hope the book, in some way, you know, creates a human element to this, and kind of what a John Hershey did with Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that it'll add a little bit of color and humanity to what was going on over there. As far as what I'm working on now, I do a lot of work around state politics in California. I'm a recovering journalist. I still deal with a lot of media in my day-to-day job. I have a political blog about California politics and media. It's called calbluedog.com. And I'm working on a book for the future about really how emotion is driving American policy and politics. And I think we're leaving the enlightened age and going back to a more visceral approach to problem solving, and I think California is really, the the center of where this is all happening. I'm seeing it every day in my job, and I'm fascinated by how emotion will trump stats and statistics in the political world.
Mm-hmm. I fight this every day as a university teacher, and from your lips to God's, or rather Arnold Schwarzenegger's ears. You guys have a lot of work to do in California.
we sure do.
Yeah, it's funny being here in Iowa and then sort of hearing about California's problems, because the dimensions are, you know, we deal with budget shortfalls that are in the, you know, 2 and 3 million range, and your budget shortfalls are in billions.
We have billion-dollar shortfalls, and this might be a good way to tie this all together. When I first started working in I worked in the California State Capitol, and there was a joke, and I started when I got back from Germany, I started here in 1991, and there was a joke that all the bureaucrats from the Soviet Union and East Germany had all ended up in California government.
I hadn't heard that, but I believe that to be true. Well, anyway, Stephen.
Well, and that's actually kind of an interesting thing. It's probably a subject for another guest in another time, but they're really, you know, we see government right now being so involved in our society and economy, you know, and as a counterpoint, 20 years ago, we were seeing how government had really screwed it up. So it's just kind of an interesting, I'm not trying to make a statement, but it's just an interesting counterpoint to everything we're seeing in our own society right now.
Yeah, no, I'll make a statement. Really big government doesn't work very well. There, I said it for you. I don't know if you meant that, but I kind of went over to the Soviet Union as a liberal Democrat, and I came back, let's just say, something else.
It's a real eye-opener.
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
There's definitely a role for government, but I think...
Yeah.
Roman Ghostland is a little bit of a cautionary tale.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, Stephen Allen, thank you very much for being on the show. I should tell our listeners we've been talking to Stephen Allen, and he's the author of Roman Ghostland, The Final Days of East Germany. I hope that you go out and pick up the book, and I enjoyed it very much. Steve, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Stephen Allen, the author of Roman Ghostland, The Final Days of East Germany. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.